ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, all around the world, democracy does appear to be under strain. Assaults on traditional institutions like the parliament and the courts are everywhere. And despite the enthusiastic predictions of some that following the collapse of the old Soviet Union and the rise of wealth in China and rising living standards, that authoritarian regimes were doomed and democracy would prevail everywhere, that has not been the case. The China model indeed appears to be thriving. Some are seeing it as an alternative to democracy. Democracy's messy. Societies are wondering whether or not, is this the best there is? As wealth inequities grow, migration pressures increase, and traditional institutions are no longer trusted. A.C. Grayling's a philosopher. He's a founder of the New College of the Humanities at Northeastern University in London. And in his new book, For the People, he argues the case for democracy and the urgency of the struggle to revive it. A.C. Grayling, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Well, thank you, Phil. It's great to be back.
Terrific to have you with us as well. Where do you see evidence of this? Where do you think the problem is? Is it in the oft cited case of America? Is it in the UK, or is it everywhere?
Well, it's everywhere in the daily news. I mean, we see what's happening with Trump's America and what Trump is doing to the institutions of American democracy. We see it Orban in Italy, in Hungary. We see it to a lesser extent in Italy, even in the UK, in fact. You look at examples of Turkey, of India under Modi. I mean, in many places, and South America is another example, we see authoritarians on the rise. We see authoritarian populist policies being implemented. And we also see, at the same time, a lot of disaffection within democracies relating to the institutions of them and how well they're delivering. And I think on that point, the point about internal dissatisfaction with the way the democracies are working, it has a great deal to do with the fact that government in democracies in so many places has really just turned into politics. I mean, you look at, Prime Minister's questions in Parliament, and what you see is campaigning. You see a political debate. You see all the headline issues that really matter to the country being a matter of controversy and struggle. And the takeover, as it were, of governance by political factionalism is one among a number of reasons. We'll talk about the others in a bit, but certainly one of them, which really turns people off and makes them feel that the kinds of difficulties we face in society, rising prices as it might be, the climate challenge, the inadequacy of responses to some of the difficulties the world faces, all that is blamed on the failure of our democratic structures to deal with them adequately. Mm. So that is one very important source.
Wasn't it ever so? Weren't our representative institutions, parliaments, always places where politics is practiced, because after all, that is in essence their purpose?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think obviously political debate is very important. You know, the question about what the direction of travel is going to be in a society, how the economy is going to be organized and so on, all these things matter tremendously. And the public conversation needs to be about that. And there need to be policy proposals put forward, debated, investigated, discussed, challenged. Yes, absolutely. But I think once a government is formed on the back of the outcome of that process, you know, once if there were a representative system that really did reflect the diversity of needs and interests and aims in society, once that great debate has been had, the idea of good government, effective government, needs to be governed by two things. First, that the purposes of government, which are to work for the benefit of all the people, not just the people who voted for you or who donated to your political party, but all the people in the state, should command a kind of consensus, again, as regards the headline issues that matter in a country. Mm. And that would only come out of ensuring that once government is constituted, it is devoted to the purposes for which government exists on the back of what has emerged from the political debate that happened beforehand. But to make government itself a site of continual political wrangling and to have a public conversation which is dominated by very partisan media very often and by the sort of trigger issues that polarize people is a way of making people disaffected with both the political process and with government itself.
Yes. What do you think democracy is? I mean, people often talk about it as though, and what was the famous quote by Winston Churchill? It's the worst system of government ever, except all the others that have been invented. What do you think people think democracy? What do you think democracy is? So, you know, there's the ancient Athenian model where every citizen, well, that is every eligible citizen, and there weren't many of those, would gather and vote on things, to today's overwhelmingly prevalent model of representative democracy, where people don't actually have a say; their representatives do the governing. What do you think it actually is to most people?
Well, ultimately, of course, it's intended to be a system in which government is effected on the consent of the people. And that is a bit of a weasel phrase in the sense that you've just described correctly there, which is that we send people as representatives with plenipotentiary powers to act on our behalf. Mm. But what they're meant to do, of course, is to look at the facts, to discuss, to get the information, listen to experts, perhaps, deliberate, and then come to a decision about what would really work for what government exists to do, namely to benefit everybody in the society, to look at the overall welfare and benefit. But the other idea that underlies it is that the consent of the people is something that can be withdrawn, that instead of having a kind of four-yearly or five-yearly audit via an election in which major political factions compete with one another for levers of power and offer to the people a menu, which is a kind of take it or leave it, list of things that the party in question proposes to do. Genuinely, that an informed and on the whole interested populace will give its consent on the basis of good information and an understanding that it is the welfare of all that will benefit each. So, I mean, we're talking about something which is a little ideal here. Mm. And as you implied in your question, in the past, parliaments were much less representative than they are now. I mean, you go back to the 19th century, for example, in the UK, and the franchise then was not very extensive. And yet, as John Stuart Mill pointed out in his book on representative government, there was a sense in which the people who went to Parliament and the people who formed the government had what he described in a rather Pickwickian phrase, a kind of constitutional morality, a sense that they had a duty to act on behalf of the country's welfare and not on their own, either individually or on their party interests. And unfortunately, what has happened in politics is that as our democratic institutions have aged and have not really reformed themselves to become more responsive, so they've fallen into the hands just of this political rank.
I was listening to a representative the other day who was recently elected to Parliament and as to why she was adopting a particular position. And she said, because the people who elected me want me to do this. This was in relation to a climate debate we were having in Australia. And she said, the people in my electorate are concerned about this issue, that is of renewable power lines, I think it was, on their properties. And so that's the issue I'm going to, that's the way I'll vote. That's what I'll do because I'm representing their interests. Now, this is one view of democracy, isn't it? I mean, I was reminded of that great quote by the English politician and thinker Edmund Burke, who said that this is not the way to behave at all. He said a representative's role, I think to summarise his point of view, wasn't to represent opinions at all. It was to use their own judgment as to what was worthwhile or good for a community. But instead, we have a view at the moment, don't we, that parliaments should simply represent the opinions of people who put them there. Now, is that a good or a bad thing, do you think?
Well, there's an obvious tension between the two. I mean, on the one hand, parliamentarians should, of course, be listening to what people say and what people's needs and desires are. Absolutely. So they should represent the people in that sense. But they are not sent as mere delegates, just conveying the opinion of the people who happen to elect them. Instead, that they are sent with a duty. And the duty is, as I said earlier, to be informed, you know, to get hold of the facts and to consider them, debate them, listen to other points of view, and to try to work out what is in the overall benefit of everybody. And if that were done authentically, if it were done with real sincerity, it might happen that some of the things that are decided by governments for the overall benefit of the people, the economy, the society, it will almost inevitably annoy some people, because you can't please all the people all the time. But the idea that you would be constrained by your own particular electorate, let us say, to go against what might be in the national interest overall, is to hide behind this idea of delegation, which politicians sometimes do. You know, they oscillate between saying, well, look, you know, I'm representing the opinions of the people in my constituency. And then on another occasion, they will say, well, I can't conform to their opinions because there is a greater good to be served here. So, I mean, that is a difficulty too. Providing there were a very clear understanding of what a parliamentarian is meant to be doing, that is, serving the interests of government when government is established, and that purpose is the genuine benefit of everybody, for all. You know that famous definition, government by the government of the people, by the people, for the people? I mean, I point out in the book that the word people in each of those sub-clauses there is a different people. Government of the people, that's everybody, man, woman, child, slave, free, whoever it might be. By the people, well, that's people who have the franchise, people who send the delegates to parliament. And for the people, well, it turns out now in our political process that it's for the people who voted for you or donated to you.
Yes.
And these are very different people. And it's somehow or other we have slipped away from thinking about what government is for. And it turns out that too often, therefore, political party machination means that parties represent not the people, but their party line. And that's one of the main reasons, really, why things have gone wrong.
Yes, I think a caller once remarked to me on the program here. He said, what's the point of voting? Why do we vote for? Why do we have all these members of the Labor Party in Parliament if they all have to vote the same way? Why don't we just vote? Why don't we just have one Labor person in the Parliament? Why do we have to have 60 of them if they're all going to vote the same way on a particular issue? We could just have one and save a lot of money. There is a point here, isn't there? I mean, but in our own constitution in Australia, political parties are not mentioned at all. But of course, they are fundamentally important in the way the country is governed. And I suspect the same thing is whether England doesn't have the same written constitution as we do, but I imagine the situation is the same there.
Oh, it's no different at all. And indeed, this was anticipated, you know, with anxiety a long time ago, at the end of the 18th century. James Madison, in writing about what structures the new government of the new United States should have, he pointed out that the thing to avoid is what he called factionalism, which is just another way of talking about party politics, for precisely this reason, that when a party gets its hands on the levers of power, it wants to get its agenda through. So it has to discipline the party members into towing the line. And that indeed means that the lobby and whipping through the lobby, that system of party discipline, disempowers MPs from what it is they're there really to do, which is to scrutinize ideas, scrutinize legislation, vote according to what they really, genuinely, sincerely believe would be in the interests of the people generally, as well as the people they more directly serve. And you see this happen, you know, in the UK, for example, a few years ago, there was a period of a couple of years when the government of the day under Theresa May had no majority in the House of Commons. And that meant that every measure brought to the floor of the House of Commons was debated on its merits, and it passed or failed on its merits, not because people were whipped through the lobbies, but because there had been a genuine debate and people were in a position to make a difference with the vote that they gave on the measure. And that is the kind of situation in the ideal one would want to see, providing, of course, that the people present, people involved in that debate, were not just trying to score political points or to engineer some advantage for themselves or some faction that they represent, but instead did it with this genuine desire to be of real service.
Mm. One of the points you make in your book is a valid one, and that is because we'll get off this topic of what is democracy in a moment, but because it's important, because when the word is bandied around, it means different things depending on where you are, doesn't it? And as you say, in the system of voting that you have, for example, in the UK, and indeed for that matter, I think in largely in the US as well, with first past the post voting. You don't need a majority to win an election. You just have to have more votes than other people in the race. And if there are quite a few people in the race, you could possibly win with 20% of the vote, because you got 20 and the other people, you know, got various other percentages. But this is a valid point, isn't it? So what is the fairest voting system? In Australia, we have a different system. We have a preference system of voting, and some states in Australia have even fairer systems as well. The Hare-Clark system, for example, is this important, do you think, or is there some more overarching thing here about the notion of democracy, or are we arguing about what the mechanic of democracy is?
Well, of course, the mechanics do matter, and the voting system matters tremendously too. It's interesting to point out that there are about 50 or more Westminster model democracies around the world. They include Canada, lots of other places. Now, some of them have adapted their electoral systems, as Australia has done. Although, and I make the following comment with a certain diffidence, of course, being not being Australia myself, but the net effect on the whole has, at least until recently, been to produce what is in fact a two-party system in Parliament. I mean, the net outcome of it is, if you had a proportional representation system which was genuinely proportional and which allowed many more voices, many more interests to be represented in Parliament, then the sort of result you get would be, no doubt, many people would think, not that much better, because of the need for coalitions and the need for
wouldn't we all just end up as being models of the Italian Parliament, which is endless coalitions dissolving and reforming, and nothing much in the country ever seems to get done?
Well, you're right there. There are certain models of proportionality which are very unproductive. So Italy, indeed, is one, and so also is Israel, where very, very, very small parties can, hold the whip hand over government. But there are other, and most of the other European countries are very much better examples of proportionality. And what tends to happen with them is well illustrated by what happens in the Netherlands, for example. So the Netherlands has quite a large number of parties represented in Parliament, and usually it takes months after an election for a government to be formed. A lot of people think that that's a nonsense. In fact, it isn't. I mean, if you think about it, what's happening when those negotiations are going forward for forming a coalition, what's being discussed is what really matters, what different interests, what different priorities there should be in a government program once a government is formed by means of coalition. It's a way of winnowing out quite a lot of the highly partisan points of view that different parties bring to the issue, and leaving a residue in the main of things that really matter. Again, those headline issues that really matter in the society. So I see that process as being, in fact, a productive one, because what one wants, you know, is thought, deliberation. And just recently I was reading Moore's Utopia, and in it the point is made that decisions taken in the Council of the King are never stamped, are never signed off on, until at least 3 days of debate have been had about them. The idea being there, of course, that people can change their mind, reflect overnight, things that people have said might start to resonate with them and so on. But the idea of a longer, more careful, more attentive deliberation on what should be done and how it should be done is important. In the party political process, the leadership tells, you know, the lobby fodder how to vote, and that's sort of it. But if you had a situation where every time an important matter comes before the parliament, it has to be discussed, and the decision made is going to be contingent upon how cogent the arguments are, how compelling the evidence is, then, again, you know, we're being a little idealistic here, but at any rate, one should always specify an ideal and see how close you get to it. And the situation that exists in places like the Netherlands, using that example, of a protracted debate about what the program is going to be and what's going to be done is a hell of a lot better than having a party with an unsurpassable majority which can do what it likes.
As Richard, my texter, says, in the case of the Labour Party, it's even worse. You can't vote against an issue. If you do, you're expelled. It's a great democracy. Yeah, well, this is true. So we need a better mechanic. We need a more democratic system. I get the sense often when I discuss this issue, Professor Grayling, I'm speaking with Professor A.C. Grayling, a philosopher and an author of a new book called For the People, an argument about what's happening with democracy, fighting authoritarianism and saving democracy. I often get the feeling when I'm discussing this issue with people that a lot of people would prefer, and we'll get to authoritarianism in a moment, but a lot of people would prefer some form of benevolent dictatorship in the community if they thought that they could really trust this. Do you think that's actually a default human position, or do humans default to democracy?
Oh, no, I think people do tend to default rather to the hope for a benevolent dictatorship, because it saves them the problem of thinking and voting and making choices and considering what you know, would be best and not best. And if you had a benevolent dictator upon whom you could rely to be rational and benign, then you're freed up to do and worry about other things. But there's a marvelous, marvelous little anecdote told by a guy called Han Fei, who was a legalist philosopher in ancient China. And the story is that a farmer one day was ploughing his field, in the middle of which stood a tree. And as he was doing so, a hare came racing by and bashed into the tree, broke its neck and died. And the farmer skinned it, cooked it, ate it, and it was delicious. So he threw away his plough and sat by the tree to wait for another hare. And the point that Han Fei was making was that delicious hares don't come along very often. Benign dictators don't come along very often. And if that's your system, you're going to find yourself in trouble when you have malign dictators controlling things. And given human nature, they are likely to be in the majority. So the point is that, you know, doing the work, taking the trouble to get involved, to listen, to find out the facts, to argue, to choose how to vote, you know, that is something which is of the first importance. It's often been said, you know, that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Well, I say the price of our civil liberties is eternal engagement. We have to protect them, because there's always a temptation to take the easier path, which is just to tell everybody what to do and to use the arms of force in the society to get them done. And that's not the way to go. Because, look, however flawed and failing democracies feel or seem to be, there is one thing which they have in common, and that is that, in general, they tend to be places where civil liberties and the rule of law are protected. And those are two incredibly valuable things. Mm. They are so valuable, and we take them so for granted that we kind of forget in a way that without a system which ultimately rests on the consent of the people and where at least in principle government is meant to be for the people, if we didn't have such a system, then our ordinary everyday freedoms, our capacity to make choices that matter to us, especially in our personal lives, and the fact that there is this banister, this rail, which is the rule of law that protects those civil liberties. Without them, we would find ourselves in a very uncomfortable position. You know, people only really recognize the great value of what they've lost when they've lost them. And this is something that we want to prevent happening by making people, or reminding people at any rate, of the importance of the things that democracy does defend.
Mm. Yes, indeed. That's how many citizens in the US might be feeling at the moment about their judicial system. I'm talking with Professor A.C. Grayling, philosopher and founder of the New College of the Humanities at Northeastern University in London, about his new book, For the People, Fighting Authoritarianism and Saving Democracy. One of the arguments you put, and this does seem cogent, is that democracy has faced now, these days, a whole lot of pressures that have never been faced before. And perhaps the biggest one is the rise of multinational corporations who no longer feel beholden to governments, the law, or nation states at all, that modern capitalism has evolved to a point which is inherently authoritarian. Can you tell me what you think? Tell me what you think about this.
Yes. I mean, this is a tremendously important point. And in fact, it is a very recent phenomenon in a way, because even though there have been very big companies in the past, and both companies and the individuals who own or control them have become very wealthy, this is something which got going full force, full throttle, from about the 1980s onwards. The growth of these enormous international corporations, which no individual government can do as much about it as it perhaps might like if it were minded to do anything. And these international corporations are able to move money, move headquarters, move to regulatory regimes where how they act, how they treat employees, how they observe standards for their manufacturers and so on, vary in ways that are cost effective to them. And it's the effect, it's the sort of depredations of huge corporations on the climate and on workforces, especially where labor is cheap in the global south, for example, that cause a lot of the dissatisfactions that people feel. They blame their own national governments for things that national governments are really rather weak in dealing with. So the power of these big corporations, which extends, by the way, even further, because, of course, the success of big international corporations is measured in money terms. These are companies, some of them now, valued it beyond the $1 trillion mark, as we've seen in recent news. They have powerful effects on national governments because they can influence tremendously in all sorts of ways, but not least through donations to political parties and individuals, as happened with Trump. They can influence public policy in ways that benefit them, and very often tend not to benefit ordinary working people. And so this is yet another reason why democracies, because they're limited in the range of their influence to the nation state itself, another reason why democracy feels ineffective. It feels that it's not delivering because there are these powers, these great international powers, these corporations that make far too many of the decisions and have too great an effect on everybody.
Yes, no, and I suppose the point about them is, to return to the question really, is that of their nature they are not democratic, are they? Capitalism tends towards monopoly. They're not interested in letting a thousand voices bloom, as it were, or consulting. They are interested in their own imperatives. And people feel as though they are powerless in the face of it, don't they? They don't even think their own governments are in a position to do anything about. the yes. likes, wishes, desires, and strategies of large corporations.
That's completely true. Yes, I mean, you know, a large corporation might say, "Oh well, we're a democracy of our shareholders," because in the end, the shareholders make the decisions. Mm. But of course, that's just a fig leaf remark. I mean, very often, major shareholders and big corporations are other corporations, and also, in any case, even individual shareholders have one interest, which is to maximize their returns from the shareholding, and therefore, they want the corporation to do whatever is going to ensure that. So, you know, when it's all about money, and I'm afraid, you know, the old cliche about money being the root of all evil, it is just altogether too dishearteningly true, because what is driving the international corporations, of course, is profit. And the profit motive is something which has despoiled the world, which has immiserated millions of people, which has organized society in such a way that we've seen, under the power of the effect of these great corporations, a rise in inequality in our world, which is absolutely staggering. You know, when you think about the wealth of some individuals and the wealth of these corporations, how much of the world's wealth they engross, and how very little else of the world's wealth is spread among the vast majority of people in the world. And, you know, what one sees the source of so many of our problems, because inequality is toxic. Very toxic, and it's very destabilizing. Mm. A lot of the problems in the world, and not just in democracies but everywhere, is the result of those inequalities. But this is something which the corporations exist to maximize. They are driving towards the sequestration of more and more and more wealth into fewer and fewer hands, into fewer and fewer agencies. And the result, therefore, is this very destabilizing and uncomfortable situation.
Yes, I remember once speaking to a very senior political leader in this country who said the key to a calm and ordered society is not to let the gaps get too big. And he was talking about the gaps between the wealth gaps, wealth inequities. But modern democracies have presided over just ever-widening wealth gaps, haven't they, in which a lot of people just feel disenfranchised. They feel as though most of the productive wealth of their community goes to fewer and fewer people. And that in itself is a fundamental cause of dissatisfaction with democracy, because they think, well, why am I participating in a system which doesn't reward or serve me?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And in fact, one can trace, because it is quite clear how it actually happened in the 1980s and thereafter, with the rise of neoliberalism, the neoliberal kind of capitalism, which was fostered by the Republican Party under Reagan in the 80s and 90s, had as its intention the idea that if you just let the forces of capitalist profiteering rip, there would be a trickle-down effect. Everybody would be benefited. You know, the tide would rise and all the boats would float up with it. Mm. That's turned out not to be true. And so what has happened is that the changes that were made by Reaganomics in the U.S. To a more modest extent, because a smaller extent, Thatcherite economics in the U.K. and elsewhere in the world, because, of course, everybody raced to follow the same kind of model to deregulate. Deregulation caused financial meltdowns. One of the most significant of recent times has been the 2008 meltdown. And it's visible. I mean, it's as clear as day that if you don't have regulated markets, if you don't watch what financial institutions are doing, if you don't test the validity of the sorts of financial packages that they trade between themselves and so on, you get this situation. You get the funneling of more and more money, fewer and fewer hands, and you get the growth of these inequalities. So it has been sort of, you know, plain as day, really, what's happened over the last 50 years in the economies, the leading economies of the world, and how they have dramatically skewed the world. And one of the results of it has been the disaffection with democracy and the temptation to let it slide into the hands of people who make promises. These populist politicians recognize the sorts of difficulties that people are in, but then they refocus the blame. They blame immigrants, or they blame what they think of as elites, you know, but they're talking about cultural elites here. They blame wokeism. They blame anything other than what's really systematically undermining the welfare of people in the country. They get power on the back of it. And then, of course, you know, one vote one last time, and then you have an authoritarian regime in power and everything that follows from it.
Mm. Yes. What to do about it, of course, is less obvious, isn't it? Because after all, modern capitalism has produced wealth beyond what most people believed was possible. It's raised the living standards of billions of people. It's brought people out of poverty. It's provided all sorts of opportunities, and so on and so forth. So it's never all one side of the equation, is it? And what you do at this point in the development of modern economies to control large corporations is not obvious, is it?
No, it's not completely obvious, but the sort of nostrums that one might come up with to try to protect the thing that we do want to protect, and that is those civil liberties and that rule of law aspect of democracy, despite democracy's imperfections, that is something well worth fighting for. And if you look at the model of China, you mentioned right at the top there how people are looking towards that authoritarian state capitalist system that the Chinese have. You notice something rather interesting about it, that the Chinese rely on the idea that if people's standard of living is high or is good enough, that they won't bother their heads with matters of politics and civil liberties. They'll be content to go along with not being allowed to do lots and lots of things and not having a say in how things are organized. And to some extent, of course, that works. It's obvious enough. But there are reasons for thinking that a much messier system, a noisier system where people are debating more vigorously, where there is much more freedom for creative and intellectual endeavor, makes for a healthier society and people who are more, as it were, sort of fitter as human beings because more exercised in their thinking and in their engagement. A very passive, a very quiescent society on the political, intellectual, and cultural side, just because they have economic satisfactions available to them, ultimately will stultify. So the idea there is that whatever else one does to try to improve the democratic orders of the current democracies, it must have as its focus the sense that reconfiguring the duty of government away from politics to governance, proper governance for everybody, done by improved constitutional means, with the aim of ensuring that our civil liberties and the rule of law are fully protected. That would be the aim. So again, that states an ideal, but again, the point is to state an ideal and see how close we can get to realizing
yeah, exactly. There was a very popular view. I'm interested in this idea that authoritarianism is inherently antithetical to rising living standards and modern capitalism and wealth making and so on. Because there was a very popular view, I think it was popularized out of American think tanks in the 1990s, that in relation to China, I mean, the view went something along these lines: don't worry about China, because after all, as their wealth continues to accumulate, as people tend to make more money, they will want more political freedom, because one follows with the other. They won't want governments to be telling them what to do. But, you know, as we've seen, this was not the case, and the Chinese Communist Party managed to show that the exact opposite was the case, and in their humiliation of you know, major billionaires like Jack Ma and so on, they showed who was boss. Now, a lot of people have looked at that model and thought, well, hang on, yes, so maybe that's more attractive than the one we're seeing in democratic regimes, because after all, as you say, people's living standards have been rising, have risen. there's relative calm. And if we don't have so much political freedom, is that a reasonable price to pay? Do you think this idea is getting more attractive, or it's simply the age-old argument of authoritarian governments?
It's definitely getting more attractive. And in fact, the attractions of it have been kind of simmering on the horizon for a while, because people would invoke the example of Singapore, an authoritarian regime which was, from the point of view of living standards, at any rate, extremely successful. And people thought, if you could replicate that, and if you could put to work a relatively benign-seeming authoritarianism aimed at improving people's living standards, then you would get something which is desirable. Desirable because people can have money, and that's a point of concern for so many. And at the same time, not be bothered about political decisions and engagement. Mm. So yes, the Singaporean model, which is now writ large in the Chinese model, that does work. But one has to notice that authoritarianism is not always about protecting itself by making people's living standards good. Look at the example of Venezuela. There you see that authoritarian politics is about authoritarian politicians much more than it is about the people, because there the country, which once was one of the most flourishing economies in South America, has been almost completely destroyed and immiserated by the clutch on power of the people who got into power. So you can see that where the destination is of an authoritarian regime and what it's prepared to do. Look at China itself. Look at what happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989. There is a limit to what they're prepared to allow people with their new living standards. And it's, as Michael Caine might say, a little known fact about China that there isn't total content and happiness in the country. In the interior of the country, which doesn't benefit from the high economic success rate of the special economic zones around the coasts, there's a lot of disaffection. And every week, there are hundreds of examples of crowds storming police stations and protesting and the rest. We hear very little about it. It leaks out through the very small democracy movement that China has. But it's there. So, this is not a total success story. It always comes at a cost. There's always in the small print of all these things some condition which it's a very, very uncomfortable condition to meet.
Mm. Do you think the internet has been a promoter of democracy or its enemy? This is a big and complicated question, I guess, but how would you see it?
Well, there are many good things on the web, there's no question, and there are many good things about social media. But my own view, and the view of many, and I don't know whether we can say on air the title of the book by Mr. Doctor just recently, but the downsides, especially of social media, but of many things on the web, are far greater than the upsides. Mm. And it's a dilemma as to how you manage them, how you keep the good and try to minimize or even get rid of the bad stuff. But among the bad stuff, of course, are all these conspiracy theories, people on the far right, the masculists, the white supremacists, the misogynists, the neo-Nazis. I mean, really, really vile things are said and done and pushed out into the public domain from these sources. And among them, of course, are attacks on democracy. Within America itself, in the United States, for example, there are these voices saying, well, we should get rid of democracy altogether. What the U.S. needs is a CEO. It needs a company director. Well, all that kind of line. Mm. And those sorts of things are becoming more and more mainstream. There was a really interesting book published recently by Julia Ebner, who is a researcher into extremism and terrorism at Oxford University. It's a book called Going Mainstream, in which she talks about how these sorts of ideas are getting out there into the mainstream and influencing, or perhaps a better term is infecting, public conversation about these things. Because the point is that the more that these sorts of points are made and aired, the more normalized they become. And then people begin to think that they are a real alternative.
Mm.
You know, they say that part of the motivation for the MAGA base and Trump supporters in America is that they want a strong man to bulldoze his way through.
They do. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. And so bulldoze his way through all the vested
interests and all of the, you know, entrenched interests and all the things that they see as making America poor.
Yeah, making them poor and putting them on the back foot and making them feel that because women are being empowered or because more people of color are getting opportunities in society, that their position is becoming less tenable. And they would like to revert to a position where racism and sexism actually operate in their interest. And so they want to see somebody who will say those things, who will give voice to those sentiments, and then who will act on them. And this is something which the internet, I'm afraid, has allowed to proliferate. It's like it's as if somebody had poured some growth factor onto the mold in your bathroom, and suddenly it had become absolutely covered by it. And this is the effect that what's happening on the web has. So conspiracy theories, for example, out of these silos where there were people who were clustering together with their appalling views and just encouraging one another. Unfortunately, those silos are spilling over. And the virality of these things, the fact that at the speed of light all around the world, people can pick up on these ideas and mimic one another. I mean, it's forgotten, for example, because we think about what happened on January the 6th, 2021, you know, when the people who rioted at the
Capitol Hill,
Washington. Yeah, we think it was kind of a one-off. But you know, there were about a dozen similar instances, both before and after that date, just around that time in December and January, around that new year. And these were, you know, this case of mimesis, of imitation, of people hearing about what was being done in another country and replicating it in their own. And this is the great danger of this source. My own view, by the way, about social media is that providing you could find a way of protecting whistleblowers and people who are very vulnerable, perhaps to attack and so on, that once you get rid of anonymity, if everybody was in, you know, cyberspace in the same way that you have to be there in your proper person with your true identity to open a bank account or become a member of a club or to vote, if the same requirement was made on you entering into any of the social media platforms, a huge amount of this nonsense, especially of vituperation, hate speech and abuse and so on, would disappear. And that idea is one which does get some discussion among people who talk about how we should try to manage social media. And one of the pushbacks you get is, people are leaving social media. Social media is being taken over by AI-driven bots. And so, you know, it wouldn't really help the problem because the AI-driven bots, you only need a few guys in Russia, let's say, or in China or somewhere, to put out millions of these bots into social media space to destabilize or disrupt or to spread misinformation. So, you know, trying to get rid of anonymity of individual users is not going to solve the problem, they say. Still, I think it would be a good thing.
All right. Look, your book is a call to action. It's called For the People, Fighting Authoritarianism and Saving Democracy. My guest has been Professor A.C. Grayling, philosopher and founder of the New College of the Humanities at Northeastern University in London. Some people might suggest a good starting point, Professor Grayling, would be to have compulsory voting like we have at Australia, which does tend to see if you engage more people, and one of the points of your book is to have more engagement. If you engage more people, you tend to get more, you tend to get milder outcomes.
Yeah, I'm 100% for it. I'm really for it.
All right. Look, there's plenty more to talk about in the book. It's a very interesting meditation and discussion and an urgent call for the values of democracy. We don't have better systems and ways to revitalize democracy and how we go about it. are the urgent themes in it. Professor Grayling, it's been terrific to talk with you, as always, and I do thank you for your time.
Thank you, Phil. All the best.
All the best, too. Professor A.C. Grayling, For the People, the book is called...
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.